This is the Way Podcast. If you want to know more about the Way Podcast, go to podcasttheway.com.
And get the ball rolling. This is FM 91.7, WHUS Stores at the top of the hour. Again, thank you, Three Interesting Things Podcast, for that new introduction. Very nice guy. Be sure to check that out. And yeah, so I'm sitting today with Hassan Oswald. How you doing today, Hassan?
I'm great. Yeah, a little cold over here in Harlem, but doing well. Thanks for having me on.
I'm over in Connecticut and same here.
But there you go.
I will say I like the cold. I figured I can turn off the heat, one of those heaters in your room, get it nice and freezing at nighttime. Oh, I love it.
Exactly. That's what I do. I make it frigid at nighttime. It's hard to get out of bed in the mornings, but it's the best way to sleep for me too.
Oh, 100%. Getting out of bed, that's the downside. Yeah, so I'm having you on the show because what's the name of the movie you directed?
The name of the film, it's a documentary feature called Higher Love.
Higher Love, 100% Rotten Tomatoes, 9.3 IMDb out of 10. Tons of awards, tons of film festival awards. So I'll be the one who brags for you so you don't have to.
Thanks.
Yeah, how does that feel winning these awards?
Yeah, I mean, it's really surreal. Like, for example, last week we won, NoFilmSchool.com named us one of the top 10 documentaries of 2020. And that's absolutely surreal because I came from a non-film background. I had no professional experience. I used to be an English teacher and I just made the jump. And the jump was into this film. So I kind of learned on the ground, and that website,
Tarantino, one of those.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so that website was, you know, I learned so many things from it. And then to see ourselves as the top documentary on there, it's pretty incredible. And that's kind of the feeling we have when we somehow, you know, it still feels like, you know, we have that imposter syndrome. I have that imposter syndrome. So every award we win or, you know, good review, it is a bit surreal, but definitely amazing.
But with no background, how do you know what to do? How do you know what angles work? How do you know how to prepare for your movie?
I mean, I went in there knowing that although I didn't have a background, I knew what I liked. I knew what I liked to watch. You know, I brought a lot of elements of narrative film, scripted film into this documentary. I knew what styles I liked. I knew what colors I liked. I knew, you know, even what music, what temp music I was going to be cutting to. The first thing I taught myself was the basics of editing. And, you know, I edited the first 30-minute cut. Kind of like a real extended sizzle. So I had no idea what I was doing, but I knew what I liked. And I let that kind of carry me for the first few months, kind of, you know, trying to duplicate shots or lighting or sounds that I was really drawn to.
So you edited the first 30 seconds where you have I watched the film yesterday myself, and you edited that beginning where they talk about Detroit and how it's almost like RoboCop. I mean, not Detroit.
Camden.
Yeah, New Jersey.
Exactly. Yeah. So I had the first 30 minutes cut. And that first scene was in it from the beginning. And I actually wrote out almost like a script on a big ping pong table with index cards. So I went in there with like a pretty good plan of how I wanted the movie to look. So yeah, that first Oki and Anthony kind of shitting on Camden, that was an idea from the beginning. And it made it all the way through the last cut.
That's nice. And I'm assuming I saw on the website you had a drone that you used for that shot. What other equipment did you get and how did you buy this equipment? How did you afford it?
Yeah, so the drone, first of all, that came directly from, so I didn't have a budget or crew or anything. So I would do kind of, you know, tricky things to make ends meet. I had a place to stay. So all I really needed was gas money and a little food money. So, and money, of course, for lenses and whatnot. So, I would donate my blood twice a week. That was the first thing I bought with that money was, that drone, that filmed that first shot of just funny. It did meet its fiery demise in one of those old factories. But, that was also
into the wall or something, or it just fell apart.
Yeah, no, it crashed into like a puddle and then caught on fire because of the water damage when we tried to cure the batteries in rice.
Oh, at least at the end.
Yeah. And then we'd also use that drone as like a Steadicam. So we just walk around with it. We found that like the gimbal is, you know, a brilliant Steadicam. So that was kind of how we afforded that drone. And then the only camera I had was the A7S. I bought the body and then the 24-70 millimeter lens. and I shot kind of just everything with that. We had a GoPro too for some underwater shots. But you know, it was the barest of bare, the most minimal running gun kit you've ever seen, that I could, you know, afford through donating blood, sometimes little return tricks at the stores that I won't get into. And then, just, you know, a little bit of savings that I left teaching with.
If I need to, get some extra money, how much can I get from donating plasma?
$50 per time. And I think you can do it 2 or 3 times a week.
3 times a week, 50
bucks. Yeah, and I think some places pay as much as like 70.
It, like, depending on your plasma, I'm assuming something like, or just the place.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I'm not a biologist. I don't know the difference about that.
Me either.
But I will say, while that you say you use the drone just for those walking shots and similar, because just watching the documentary, the lighting, the setting, it doesn't shake around. It all just looks well together. And obviously other people feel the same way.
Yeah, I'll take some credit for that. But I had a brilliant post team that really made it come together really nicely. Tristan Bayless did an incredible job on the audio, because you know the worst part of a first time filmmaker is going to be they don't appreciate the importance of good sound, and that was me through and through. So I had a really good team to make it look beautiful, but. Yeah, it definitely came together nicely. I'm really happy with the final product.
Yeah, we're talking a lot about what goes into it, but so the audience knows, what is your documentary about? What is Higher Love?
Sure. So it is a documentary that takes place in Camden, New Jersey, and it follows our protagonist, Daryl Gant, as he searches the infamous streets of Camden, looking for his long-term girlfriend of 10 years who's addicted to heroin mostly, but crack and, you know, everything in between. And she's pregnant with his unborn child. So it follows his journey trying to save her. And then also a side thread would be Nani's drug dealer, Iman. He was once a successful contractor and he fell into heroin use. And now he's Nani's drug dealer. And so it follows his path into recovery, or an attempted recovery as well. But so it definitely, a general, you know, driving theme through it is the opioid epidemic, but it's really in the background, and we think that it reaches a broader out to broader themes, such as, you know, the fall of post-industrial America, that is Camden, New Jersey, but it can also be seen in Flint, you know, Detroit, Cleveland. A lot of these cities are dealing with this post-industrial American neglect. So it is a story about post-industrial decay, the opioid epidemic, but it's also about love, and what we will do for love, as seen through Daryl, but also as seen through Nani, his drug addicted girlfriend.
Definitely. At the very end, you put out a statistic that says 200,000 Americans died of an opioid overdose from filming of that documentary, 2016 to 2019.
Yeah,
and you constantly see these numbers thrown around, and you see all these stats, and the people become a number. Just watching your documentary, I told you this, like, I'm doing a future episode just on like the stats and science, but then watching this movie, it brings the more humane side. I mean, right off the bat, like you said, Nikki's this pregnant woman who is taking heroin, taking crack, and it just like really makes you realize these few people have this whole thing going on for them.
Yeah, and that's really what we wanted to do. We wanted to make a film that showed the human side of the devastating consequences of this epidemic we're going through. And we knew we wouldn't get that through sit-down interviews and talking heads and politicians. We knew we had to see it, you know, as visceral and as intimately as possible through these characters. And so that's why we actually, you know, went back and forth to whether or not we should even include that stat at the end, because we didn't want to take it away from this. You know, it's more than fly on the wall. It's like almost, you know, it even borders on narrative scripted film. So it just, the access we were given, and the trust these characters gave us. So, I'm glad that came through for you, because that's exactly what we wanted to show. We wanted to show the human consequences of this epidemic without, burying our audience in, stats and, talking head interviews and, political, back and forth.
You say political, you could show 90% of the politicians this movie, you can show them any statistic and they won't do anything.
Correct.
the sad reality. But how did you even find these people? Like, starting with Daryl, seeing as he's the protagonist, how do you even find him?
So I didn't have a crew, as I said before, so I had no other option to just hit the, you know, boots on the ground. I just walked up and down the streets. I did have, once I got there, I established some connections. April Saul is an amazing photojournalist there. And she was one of my first connections. She introduced me to a program, and the leader kind of introduced me to people on the street who were suffering from addiction. And the first group I met was, you know, who we call the group, and we meet them in a motel, of which Nani, Daryl's girlfriend, is the pregnant one. And so I just met them very organically. And I think that allowed, like, right away, a trust to be built that, you know, I wasn't there to exploit them. I wasn't there to make a quick buck off of them and then leave. I was there to, you know, let them regain some semblance of agency and some voice. And it's pretty incredible what they allowed me, how deeply they allowed me into their lives and what they allowed me to capture. I just literally met them on the street. And Daryl, I got an angry phone call one day from Nani's number, and it was Daryl, and he was furious at me for filming his pregnant, drug-addicted girlfriend. And then he calmed down, and we met the next day. He said, okay, let me tell you my side of the story. And then from there on out, we kind of split time between the group and Daryl's, seemingly never-ending cyclical journey of finding her on the streets.
Seems lucky that it just happened out like that.
Yeah.
So that just shows, like, how real it is. Like, you just find that, and there's probably so many other crazy stories that we'll never even know about, too.
Exactly. And I always think, like, photo, I don't even know what it's called, but Humans in New York, that I guess it's a blog, but what's a Facebook page and whatnot, where he just goes around taking pictures of random people, and they tell a quick snippet of their life. I'm really inspired by that, and always have been. It's like, if I found this story just the way I did, as you said, there's, you know, countless incredible, heartbreaking, and definitely documentary worthy stories out there that are just kind of right beneath our nose.
100%. That's actually one of the reasons I even decided to start podcasting, because I had like 8 jobs at the time. Future employers don't listen, but I had like 8 jobs by the time I was 20. And I met a guy who had the longest coma in all of Connecticut, and that was in like one of those. I just thought that was crazy. Met a guy who was in like the most ghetto part of East Hartford, thought that was crazy. And it's just stuff like that. It's cool that you find one of those stories and you're able to make a documentary like that and just shed light to it.
Yeah, for sure.
In the movie, we don't see like a phone call with Daryl, like you mentioned. What are these people like when the camera's not rolling?
Kind of exactly. So I would say Daryl's a bit more, this is toward the end when they were completely comfortable with me and having the camera around. It was almost no difference between when I'd start recording and when I'd just be hanging out with them. But of course, anytime a recording device comes out, the environment shifts. And you can't help that, but it's just up to the filmmaker or the podcaster to keep that shift into the, I don't know, artificial or into the...
trying to make it look as real as possible. Correct. Make it actually real.
Right, exactly. So that, of course, happens the second the camera turns on. It kind of makes a little shift. But they kind of became completely comfortable with me. And I would say, you know, toward the end, everything was the same, camera on or off, but definitely toward the beginning, you could see them either shying away or maybe even embellishing a little bit to hide other things or to compensate for other things. But as my film continued, or my film journey over there in Camden continued, it became kind of not noticeable at all.
I was going to say, when in the beginning of the film, I had the idea that Daryl and Eamon's father, Raymond, mm-hmm. I had a feeling when watching them that they were sort of trying to like act in front of the camera, like, listen, you need to do better. Like when Daryl's telling his girlfriend Nani, like, oh, I love you, sweetie, and like trying to be all nice outside of the car, stuff like that. I thought it was kind of, again, trying to look great, like, oh, I'm the good guy. But then halfway through or towards the end of the film, it just all looks so much more natural, and you see, like, oh, he actually seems like a good guy. It actually seems like what's going on is really going on. He's not just trying to be the better looking one, or
right. And that's like kind of the beauty of documentary film. Like, not only are you seeing the journey that these characters are on, you're seeing the journey that the filmmaker and the characters have, and how those kind of facades and walls start to crumble. Like, for example, that huge fight when Daryl kicks Nani out of the car and they're screaming, he's screaming at her on the street. That was the first time that like that fourth wall came like crumbling down. And he, you know, he even looks at the camera with this kind of like, whoa, what just happened? Look, that was the first time he really let go in front of the camera. And then from there on out, you could kind of see this almost that, you know, the camera wasn't even there and they really, really became completely comfortable.
Well, that's good. I mean, not good with the fight, but
right. Yeah,
good. Breaks that wall. What do you do when you just see that happens? You're sitting there with your camera. Daryl sitting next to you and he's really pissed after that heated argument. Do you just keep looking at the camera, or do you like say, like, do you say anything?
No, like that was what I struggled most with. And you know, it seems like it's awkward. It's his friend, but you want to hold that silence as long as possible. Not only in scenes like that, but kind of any scenes where they're struggling with what to say. The last thing you want to do is jump in with some, you know, guiding question about what you want them to say. Like whatever they're going to come up with next is going to be kind of like gold. You just got to sit awkwardly and wait for it.
You're like a fly on the wall, like pretend you're not even there.
Right.
Wow. Did I'm assuming, were there ever times they're in an argument or something? Would they ever go to you and be like, you see this? You see what's going on? Or
yeah, definitely. not to the camera, but definitely like as like I was friends with both of them and they'd both try to, you know, plead their case to me when the camera was off or on. So yeah, that definitely happened a few times.
You just have to do your best again, be quiet and just like can't respond. Right. Sorry.
Right.
So all right, going into film again. So again, Nani, she's addicted to heroin, addicted to crack, she's pregnant in the beginning of the film. What can you, I guess, tell me about her?
Sure. Yeah. She was pretty, she kind of maintained, I don't want to say a high, but she maintained that character throughout. And I think it's, you know, it's really sad to say, but I think that her being high is her now, unfortunately. And you know, she talked about, I'm not sure if it made the final cut, but about how it changes, she's well aware that it changes her brain, you know, burns it out basically. And so, you know, at times throughout the process, I had hope for Nani. I really did. Not as much hope as Daryl did. I kind of took a more pessimistic approach of not being fooled again, because, you know, in the film we see her as we escape the night before rehab once. In reality, it happened like 5 times while I was filming. So it's happened probably, you know, 50 times in the last 10 years for Daryl. So he, you know, love is a strange and blinding force that I wasn't blinded by. So I kind of saw the harsh reality of what was coming toward the end of the film. Yeah, she, you know, she's really, really sweet. She was amazing. She, you know, she looked after me when we were in the streets. They all did. They all kind of took me under their wing, strangely enough.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure you're a fish out of water and like everywhere.
Right. She's really sweet. Obviously, she's, you know, very damaged, very drug addicted. But, you know, I can't say enough of whether that's the burned out drug Nani or with just like an echo of the real Nani, which I never knew. Of 10 years ago, pre-drugs, I'm not sure, but, you know, I was a big fan of Nani, and I really, really hope and pray that she can somehow eventually see the light before it's too late. Unfortunately, that help won't come from Daryl anymore, because he had to save, you know, himself and his child, but yeah, I wish her all the best, and them all.
Yeah, watching the movie, you root for Yvonne, you root for Nani, you want them to turn their lives around. And she says lines like, if I die, I die. I just don't want to go to hell. And I think you put down the trailer too, and it's just stuff like that. She says she knows how awful this drug is, and she knows right. How much she hates it, but she literally like can't stop.
Right, exactly. That's exactly it.
In the documentary, it showed up briefly, but I remember you see Daryl showing the camera pictures of their past. And they really do look like a happy couple.
Yeah, I mean, they were pre-drugs. They were, you know, a happy, in love, beautiful couple. You know, Daryl's obviously still, you know, strikingly young and handsome looking. He's got a, you know, incredible amount of
it.
He's got an incredible amount of charisma, especially, you know, for what he's gone through. But Nani, you know, Nani's obviously, life on the street has not been kind to her, but in those pictures, you see this kind of vibrant, young, Latina woman who's, you know, stunningly gorgeous. And you can see kind of echoes of that now, even when she's been on the streets for a decade. And you can see, you know, this kind of hopeless trap that Daryl fell into of heartbreak and love and addiction. But yeah, those old pictures, you can kind of catch a glimpse of, as Daryl says, the better times.
Nikki, she tried a methadone to get over her addiction, and if that failed, following them for 4 years, do you have any idea what could work? Because again, they're in and out of rehab. Places like Oregon are trying to decriminalize all drugs and stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have that much to say policy-wise. I will say that keeping resources from these addicts is not the way to go, kind of trying to starve them out. You know, getting rid of the safe needle exchanges, the very few that existed, getting rid of the methadone clinics. I do understand they attract a crowd that, you know, nobody wants as neighbors, or no city wants within its limits. But I think that to try to either arrest your way out of this epidemic or starve out the few groups that are doing anything, I think that's going to be never, ever going to work. So I'm not even commenting on the drug war as a whole, which, you know, well, I will. I'll say that it's, you know, been a complete failure in my opinion. I will say that I would like to see U.S. drug policy, especially in these cities, that it's been the drug war on drugs has been most detrimental to. I'd like to see them push toward, as you said, more of an Oregon model. Sure, we haven't seen it work in the U.S., but if you look over at what Portugal did, you know, more than a decade ago, it's been incredibly successful. So I would, you know, hope that the U.S. would push toward a less punitive approach and a more rehabilitative approach.
100% agree. Hope so. But again, so your film's focusing on the more humane versus the policy. It just shows the real human while all of that goes around. Sidetrack, I talked with someone who followed a kilo of cocaine has created and expedited from Colombia, mentioned the war on drug, and he went for like a good 5-10 minutes about the war on drugs and its failures and just absolute failure.
Yeah, I mean, there's little that you could pull out that would be seen as even a mild positive of this war on drugs.
They're gonna try to get the drug regardless, as you've seen, and that's why in the film I remember Daryl gives her $5 and like he keeps giving her money so she can buy her drugs. That way she doesn't just go around and just do work, as he puts it.
Right. And that's a heartbreaking scene, and I'm glad you bring it up. But it's also a heartbreaking reality. You know, it's either he give her enough for her to bring home to tide her over till it's time to go to rehab or till he can figure something else out. But that keeps her off the streets. That keeps her, you know, as Daryl says, from working the streets. And he's under no illusions of what working the streets mean and how these people in those addicted to drugs, how they go about getting that drug money. So it's, you know, sometimes, you know, you could take a view of that as an enabler, but I really don't see that in this case. He's doing what he thinks is best for her health. And in this case, I would, you know, agree with him.
We're following the story of, well, her being pregnant and then having her kid, Darnass. But you also see a glimpse that he actually has other children. Can you tell me a thing about them? Why weren't they more in the film?
Yeah, so they played a more predominant film. Daryl, I believe he's got 7 grown children. And we had a few scenes with them. At the end, it came down to a time constraint and kind of questions. That opened up more questions than they answered. So yeah, he's got 7 kids. He deals with a lot of, he's the leader of the house and still, you know, at one point they were all living together under his roof and, you know, he couldn't afford rent. He couldn't, on top of all the money he was spending on Nani's programs and everything. So he was supporting, you know, 10 people. And they all have, you know, individual issues that he has to deal with, whether it's, you know, I won't speak, you know, too deeply on this, but it's a lot of time it's monetarily based that he supports them as well. So the cutting of them came more from just a function of brevity, a function of trying to cut time off the film. They definitely played a large role in that overall frustration and kind of stress that was heaped upon Daryl.
Can you say any of what was cut out?
Let me think. There was a scene, so the birthday scene was very extended, and it really went on to include, it's still one of our favorite scenes, but it went on to include interviews with Cece and I believe his sons, the two younger sons who we saw rapping in that birthday scene. So there wasn't anything like, anything that we hadn't heard before. So Cece was friends with Nani before the addiction. And so she kind of gives a view of pre-drugs Nani. And there was little scenes like that. We had an outside fire pit once. It was just kind of more of the same as far as the frustrations that Daryl faces and the challenges that him and Darnez face, him as a single father moving forward.
In that scene too, I remember that daughter hides his absolute vodka bottle, and like, it's his birthday, so okay, I get it. Like, if I'm in his situation, I want to be stressed for a day because it sounds like he's dealing with a lot of stress. But then there's another scene where Nani's in the car and he says, why don't you quit your drugs or something like that? And then she says, why don't you quit your alcohol?
Right.
So behind the scenes, is he drinking to sort of deal with everything going on?
Yeah, certainly. And, you know, there are many forms of addiction that take place in this film. Drug is obviously the most prevalent, but, destructive love is definitely one of a form of addiction that Daryl struggles with. But Daryl certainly, enjoys his libations. I've never seen him, lose control. I know in the film and outside of the film, Nani has described, other episodes. He keeps it well under wraps. But he, and I think he'd be the first to admit this, that, he does drink to let go of these, these mountains of stress and anxiety that are heaped on him. He at one point, we weren't filming, but he was, losing his hair in little patches. So not like Meryl pattern baldness, but like stress patches. His health was, he was on, all these anti-stress medications. So it really, really took a toll on Daryl's state of mind, and I think that comes through in a veiled way through his drinking in the film.
In that situation, I feel like you have to. He's like the rock, or like the center of everything going on, like the only one who's basically able to like stand on his own.
Yeah, totally agree.
And also, yeah, he has a job which helps out with the situation. He's making $40 an hour doing, what was it again?
Yeah, he's a printing press operator. So it's a great job. And that's kind of what's kept him afloat all these years.
That's their saving grace. I feel like without that, it could just, it's already this chaotic mess, but without any of that money it could have completely fallen apart.
Right. And that was kind of, it was the good and the bad double-edged sword, because that income allowed these people to depend on him for so long. And for better or for worse, that kind of, brought him to a breaking point.
Do you think that's a good thing then? Because like then if they're depending on him, that's bad, and bringing that breaking
point. It's certainly a bad thing. But
then without it, like you said before, they could probably just go around working on the street or doing even like worse stuff.
Yeah, totally. And all the people in his life do have a certain amount of dependency on him, whether it's his kids, whether it's Nani. And he's the most amazing father in the sense that he'll never turn his back on his kids. He'll never turn his back on Nani. And that's, it's ruined and, brought him to the brink of breaking, but you can't fault someone for, having that instinct.
Again, he seems like a good father. And 6 months later, eventually the kid, Darnez, he's born, And you see some great scenes where he's dancing with a baby, playing with a baby, and you feel like everything's starting to get better and turning around. I think he says that he thought that would fix Nani, but I guess it just doesn't. It just continues on.
Yeah, and it's kind of like a commentary on the cyclical nature of the addiction. It's, you know, kind of seemingly never ending. And we had an earlier ending to the film where he was about to leave the city and forget her. This was before it was decided he was going to go to Nebraska. And he realizes she has a key of his that he needs to get out before he can leave. And so he just falls. It's the end scene of the movie, and he's back in Camden searching for her through these abandos, you know, yelling at her about his keys. Where are they? He never wants to talk to her again. So, you know, if he didn't get out and have this, you know, this bit of a happy ending in Nebraska, I think, you know, that would be continuing still. So I think you really got to give Daryl props for recognizing the cyclical nature, not only of addiction, but definitely of love. And, you know, this heartbreak he's going through, and he was able to leave that chaotic circle of all those things.
It's not a storybook ending, but it's a happy ending.
Right.
Yep. And that would hopefully, Darnaz, he gets to grow up in a whole new environment. Happy for that. What about Iman? Iman. So he's a second story going along with the documentary, although they do overlap a tiny bit. What can you tell me about him?
Yeah, so he's... I won't give away the ending, but he's not doing well currently. I heard from him around New Year's. I heard from his father also before that. You know, he's going through some pretty serious health issues. Since the festival run, Ty, who you see briefly in the film, she's the transgender character in the film. We see her briefly in the motel, and she actually played a much bigger role before the edits. She passed away drug related, and we unfortunately think that, you know, Iman might be trending in that direction, just from recent reports about his health and his addiction.
Unfortunate. We get introduced to him. I remember he moved 10 kilos of heroin every week. He's making money and or sturdy in his own sense, but again, he's doing a ton of heroin. He's, I want to say 5 grams each time.
Yeah, I mean, he used to be a kingpin in Camden in the 90s when Camden was like the Wild West. And that's when he was moving that huge weight, you know, 25,000 a week easily. And he caught a dealer's habit, as he explains in the film, and has just been unable to kick it for the past, you know, 2 decades almost. I still have, you know, reserved hope, but definitely hope that he's able to turn it around. But it's, you know, as you see in this movie and as you see in, you know, any kind of addiction study, it's going to be tough, and it's tough for all of these people suffering from addiction.
Is it because of Nikki and everyone else that he keeps sort of falling back into it throughout the film?
Yeah, definitely. As you see in the film, you know, he was doing really well at that program and he came back clean. And, you know, earlier in the film, his father said, you got to get clean, but you also got to get away from the city. You got away from these people, these influences. And he agrees. And then, you know, first thing he does is come back to Nikki. And, you know, that restarts a downward spiral. So that's, you know, as big of an influence as the drugs themselves, in my opinion. It's the environment in which Iman and these other people suffering from addiction put themselves in or can't get out.
It's the crazy little things that while watching the documentary that just stand out to me. Like, I remember he walks up to the front porch and Nikki and I don't remember who else she was with, but they're under a blanket on the front porch, like taking the drugs, like out in the open.
Yeah, that's kind of how it is over in Camden. It's improved, definitely, and it is improving day by day, by week, but it's still kind of an open air drug market.
And like, what about the cops throughout the film? Like, are they always trying to avoid it? Did you ever have a run in with them or anything?
Yeah, so I filmed with them a good bit. I had a really good relationship with it. They don't do much as far as daily, you know, door to door, porch to porch. It's kind of, you know, it would be a drop in a bucket to go up to this porch and arrest, which, as we talked about before, won't do anything, arrest these people addicted to drugs. So it's kind of, they, I don't want to say sit back, but you know, they're they're pretty reserved in their enforcing small, you know, street deals or scenes such as the one you see on the porch.
All of this going on in for about 4 or 5 years, what made you even want to make this film?
Yeah, so my dad's from Camden originally. Him and his family lived there until the, I want to say the 70s. And, you know, it was a predominantly Italian city at that time. And then with the, so for example, the Newark riots, Newark, New Jersey, those coincided with Camden riots, and it kind of spurred this white flight that, you know, happened all over the East Coast. But the white flight out of these fallen industrial towns that, you know, built America, you know, whether it's RCA or Campbell Soup or the shipyards, that was the kind of city that my father lived with his family. So I had always heard of, you know, stories from Camden, whether my dad used to work in the soup factories. So it always, you know, that seed had been planted early on. And then growing up, I remember like we'd go see my grandma, and, you know, while everyone left Camden, they're all in the surrounding area. So I'd still hear stories, you know, always horror stories about what was happening in Camden. So I kind of gained this, like, I guess almost morbid curiosity with the city. And when I was leaving teaching, I didn't have a budget. So it was a 2-hour drive from New York City, and that seed had been planted. And I just said, you know, let's give it a go. What's the worst? The worst could happen would have been pretty bad, but what's the, if it's too dangerous, too gritty, I'll just turn around and drive right back home. And I didn't. I stayed for 2.5 years off and on.
Did it ever get dangerous, or did anything bad ever really happen?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure it was always dangerous. It's consistently ranked one of America's most dangerous cities. You know, there's countless shootings while I was there. But at the same time, you know, it's I think it's a bit overblown, you know, day to day as far as what's going on in the streets. You go to these gas stations on the edge of these cities, anywhere in the country, and you roll up your windows quickly and avert your gaze as these, you know, addicts come to your window. And that was me too. But, you know, after time in Camden, you learn that with like a little patience and a little empathy, you can kind of quell those feelings of terror and distrust within yourself. So it was dangerous. Of course it was dangerous. But toward the end, it went from, you know, I was worried about getting shot or mugged, and I never worried about that anymore, getting my camera stolen. Once I gained the trust of those on the street, it went to more toward, stepping or sitting on a needle. Those are all around, or, you know, accidental exposure to fentanyl or that kind of thing, or just the hazards of the landscape. So I guess the most dangerous thing, the worst thing that happened was I fell through the roof of the Campbell's Soup Factory while taking one of those time lapses in the film, and my tripod caught on the roof, and so I didn't fall like the 40 feet onto rebar.
Literally kind of died right there.
Yeah, definitely. So like things like that turned out to be more treacherous. You know, me being an idiot turned out more treacherous than a reputation that the city's gained.
Yeah, I remember the Campbell scene. Did you throw that in to show sort of an idea of what the city was before? Is that why you included that?
Yeah, certainly. But so you saw briefly Marianne, the old homeless lady, come to the window. Yeah. I filmed with them almost as much as I did with Daryl inside that old factory. And we'll put out some episodes. I think there's actually one episode on our social media already. But I had spent a lot of time in that factory with them. It's an incredible, eerie kind of time capsule. So I did include it because it gave kind of a glimpse of the past of Camden, the heyday. But that was, you know, a major character, or not, that was a major location for our film, either way.
Yeah, and right off the bat, you see a Daryl pointing around like, oh, you see this bed, these beds, this is where they sleep at nighttime. And it just, yeah, right into that. You mentioned something like at the gas station, you have to, in the beginning, you were like looking around like somebody trying to sell me drugs or something. But then throughout the movie, there's maybe like two scenes where Daryl's speaking, somebody walks by and says, hey, you want dope? And Daryl's
like, I'm good, I'm good.
Yeah, exactly. Was that like a common occurrence that you just eventually decided to cut out?
I don't think so. I think everyone kind of knew what I was doing there after a few months. they weren't trying to cop to me. I remember that one scene with Daryl, and that was funny. We kept that in. Yeah, it could definitely happen a few times.
The nanny one is the other one I try to think of, where she said, "I want some dope," and then someone else is like, "Yo, I want some dope too." Stuff like that.
Oh yeah, that's her brother. Yeah, they kind of worked the street together. That's her brother. Yeah.
Okay, so yeah, it's not a common occurrence then. Okay.
I think what happened, especially in like those scenes, they go to what they call trap houses, and they just knock on the door and go in real quick and get it. So everyone knows where to get it, and no one really wanted to peddle it to me.
Yeah, it makes sense. I'm sure you don't. Well, how much of the part do you have to look like? Do you try to blend in, or are you just okay wearing whatever clothes you have?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely stuck out in a majority minority city. But you know, I always, you know, my camera is small. I tried to blend in as much as possible. Everyone just kind of forgot I was there after a few months, I think. You know, the cops even stopped, you know, pulling me over, or because, you know, it's called Heroin Highway right through Camden, because, you know, people from outside of the city come in for the purest, cheapest cocaine, crack and heroin on the East Coast. So what they do is they run the license plates as soon as anyone comes in, and they pull you over if you're from out of town, thinking, you know, that you're this, you know, high school kid took his mom's car to go to Camden to cop or to score drugs. So, you know, after a while that all stopped and I was just kind of left alone.
I remember the trap house part. Iman is in the car going to rehab, and he tells the driver, like, he's having this nice little chit chat with the guy. He's like, "Oh, that's my trap house, by the way." The driver's like, "Oh, really? Like, oh yeah, he probably has his own big trap house, I'm sure."
You're talking about Iman?
Yeah, when he's going to rehab.
Yeah, he still had, he was still very, is still very active in the game, certainly.
Were there any misconceptions, or what were some things you just didn't expect to see or happen?
Yeah, I mean, just kind of what we talked about before, we're touching on it again. You know, it's certainly a troubled city, and a lot of troubled people within it, especially those suffering from addiction. But
so similar to what you expected going into it?
Yeah, the resilience of the city and the people really struck me. I mean, they've been dealt a terrible hand, and you know, no one, whether it's a forgotten post-industrial American city that gets very little attention or help, or if it's the individuals living within this city, you know, none of them woke up one day and said, "Oh, I want to lose everything, my family, my house, my money, and live in the gutter in Camden, New Jersey for the next decade and a half." And so it was really striking to see the resilience of the city and those within it, whether they are addicted or not. And you know, you see it even more within locals who are within this city. The resilience was really striking to me, and still is.
There's a lot of theories, or everybody's different for why some people suffer from addiction. But one of the leading ones I remember hearing about was people want to escape their life, so they go to these drugs as a sort of escapism. And Nani seems like she has a good husband. She could have a good family going for her. And instead of like the drug being very addictive, which it is, I'm not saying that's not the reason, she seems like she would have a really good situation if she was able to quit it for good.
Yeah, but I think the escapism you mentioned goes a lot deeper than, and even Nani says it herself, you know, she says, "Well, I got a beautiful baby bouncing boy. I got a husband who's got a good job, or a boyfriend who's got a good job. You know, but somehow I just can't tear myself from the streets." So that's how deep the addiction goes. And you know, the escapism comes in not just from her leaving her baby and her long-term boyfriend. But it's this kind of cyclical nature and stigma of addiction that, you know, you do a drug, you get addicted, and then the stigma and the shame that follows that drives you right back to the drugs. So that's, I think, a big part of what Nani's addiction is, that the fact that she is leaving her baby and the love of her life for these drugs. But I think it stems from a much, you know, earlier route to escapism. You know, Nani had a terrible childhood, two drug addict parents, died with needles in their arms. So, you know, Nani, certainly her struggles did not start in Camden. They started prior to her drug use. And you know, I can't speak too deeply on it because it's a very personal matter for Nani herself to explain. But from what she's talked to me about in the camera about, that's exactly what it was. You know, She was covering up pain from whether it was abusive or drug addicted parents. That's where the drugs first, you know, started playing a role in her life.
Do you think that's a overarching theme with like everyone else, like say Nikki and Iman, like them too?
Yeah, definitely. Sure. Yeah. Iman's brother died, as you see in the film, and that tore apart his family. And that turned him to drugs. And so that's, you know, that can't be more cut and dry. That's, you know, him escaping this incredible pain. And you know, his father fell into that as well. And his father luckily was able to escape that destructive lifestyle. But it definitely is a overarching theme between all our characters.
The father said he was an addict from when he was 14 years old to his 40s. But I remember, too, also that scene with Iman when he's in the cemetery and he's pointing around like saying, oh, that gravestone, I know who killed him. Oh, that one, he died from this. Then like, he points to one where the guy's still alive, actually. But like he just completely like knows, like you said yourself, he was a drug king or
kingpin. Yeah.
Kingpin. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's kind of that brief scene kind of illustrates that, you know, what the city has been through. And Iman's kind of somehow escaped that. He's just walking randomly through a cemetery and he's like, I know this guy got shanked. And he's like, this guy ain't dead yet, but he's already got his tombstone. So that's like really speaks to what's going on in the city, that someone would pre-buy a tombstone and pre-design it.
I remember he says he wishes he was the one who died over his brother. He's just really that far down on himself. He's really that upset about himself.
Well, it's his younger brother, so he feels like he let him down. And then there's also the aspect of Iman has seen what that death did to his whole family and what it did to him. So, you know, he in many ways probably considers death better than what that death resulted in, which was the tearing apart of his family, but also this long path into, you know, a horrible destructive addiction.
Yep, I can see that. All right, so the documentary is called Higher Love. What made you give it this name? What does that mean?
This was a comment on the fact that you can't really say, like, for example, you can't quantify what love is. So what love is to someone. Someone who's not yourself. So, for example, Daryl has this deep and seemingly everlasting love for Nani. Nani has this, no matter who showers her with what, whether it's love or money or promises of a comfortable life with her husband and her beautiful child. You know, at the end, and Daryl says it. He says, you know, Nani's love was drugs or addiction, and she couldn't turn away from that. And Daryl at the end makes a decision to turn towards saving his son rather than Nani. So he chooses the love of being a father over the very destructive love and history that he shares with Nani.
How much time did you spend with all of these characters? So, like, the film took about 4 years to make, but how much time did you spend with, say, Iman, Daryl, any of these characters?
It's hard to quantify. I'd split a lot of my days among them. I definitely spent the most time with Daryl. I'd say off and on, I spent, who knows? You know, I was off and on 2.5 years in the city before we started the post. I don't know. It's really hard to say. Weeks. You know, and then I would come back on weekends once I had a freelancing job back in New York City. I'd go back to Canada on weekends. A weekend here or there toward the end. I really can't kind of put a number on it, but off and on for 2.5 years, split pretty evenly between all of them. I guess leaning more heavily toward Daryl.
You said you heard from a few of them around New Year's and recently. Are you still in contact with them all?
Yeah, I mean, I was just talking to Daryl right before this. I talked to Daryl a lot. And then, you know, it's harder to keep in contact with the characters still living on the streets of Camden. But I, you know, check in a lot. And when they can, I hear back from them. You know, it's tough. It's COVID. It's the winter. It's a lot of the same that we saw in the film as far as them, the group on the streets. So yeah, I do keep in contact with all of them, but definitely predominantly Daryl.
Do you ever plan on doing maybe like a short follow-up or something down the road?
Yeah, I'd love to follow up on especially Darnez and his development and potential developmental issues with what he went through. That's definitely in the back of my mind always.
Again, this is your first documentary, right?
Correct.
So this is your first documentary. You directed, produced, filmed, 4 years in the making. So what comes next? Do you have any new projects you want to start looking into?
Sure. So yeah, I'm actually just wrapping up for the last year and a half almost now. I've been back and forth between Syria, Iraq, and Turkey predominantly. And we're just wrapping up a film about the Yazidi genocide at the hands of ISIS. The Yazidis are an ancient people with an ancient religion. And when ISIS swept through in 2014, 2015, they captured and enslaved or executed 10,000 Yazidis, and 3,000 of them are still missing. So the film follows one family's journey to bring back all their missing members. And yeah, we're just about wrapped filming, probably have one more trip. So I just got back from Syria right before the holidays. And so we're really excited about that. And that's next up on the docket.
Wow, that's pretty quick. I thought you were going to say you were just planning a script for something next.
Yeah, really quick. So when we started our festival run, so a year ago now, January, we premiered in one Slam Dance. And right before that, I'd made my second trip there. So it was initially supposed to be a scouting trip as we started the festival run for Higher Love. And it kind of just really snowballed. And we were right away kind of entangled in a rescue that was going on. And so we just ran with it, and I would go back and forth. Luckily or unluckily, the festivals all went online because of COVID. So I was able to participate in all the festivals virtually, which I would never have been able to had to go to them all in person. So, it really sucked that a lot of our festival run got canceled or moved online. But at the same time, it allowed me to really get moving on this next doc.
Just really unfortunate timing, huh?
Yeah.
Well, I'll be looking forward to seeing that film too when it comes out. When do you think?
Yeah, so we're in the edit now. So we're still hoping for mid-2021. That's looking like a bit of a pipe dream, but we'll keep chugging along. So sometime this year, hopefully.
Sounds good. Well, I think I'm going to wrap it up. Thank you for coming out to the show.
Awesome. Thanks for having me, Bill.
Just last thing, is there any final message or any final point you want to get across for the audience?
Let's see. Yeah, I guess I could. I always, people ask how I was able to make this jump into directing from, or documentary film in general, from very little, no professional experience and very little film experience or film background. And I was really, really, I think one of the first things on this podcast I said was imposter syndrome. And I had that for a long time. And of course, I still have it. And I think that that's not something that you should carry with you. For example, nobody would give me a job when I just wanted to be an intern. And no one would hire me to do anything, let alone, I had these little travel videos. I knew how to edit, but without any kind of credit, no one would hire me. Finally, Nick West did at Goldcrest did midway through Camden, filming Higher Love. But, if you want to make a change, especially into film, don't listen to this kind of pay your dues, wait for your big break, climb up the ladder slowly, this hierarchy that kind of keeps people down in the film world. Just kind of go do it. We live now in a time where everyone's got 4K on their cameras. Everyone's got access to YouTube to learn how to edit or whatever you want to do film-wise. So kind of just don't listen to this pay your dues crowd and just go do it. That's what I did. I took a bit of a risk, and it's certainly panning out now.
It definitely is. And I'm assuming you probably came real close to quitting at some points, right?
No, honestly, I really didn't. I really enjoyed even the toughest part. And part of the reason I didn't succumb to that urge to quit, I think, is probably because I didn't have a plan B. I had given up my teaching career.
You were just all in it. You knew what you wanted.
I went all in knowing that that would kind of put me in a corner, which is how I operate best, I guess. So I didn't have a plan B.
Sounds good. Well, again, thank you for coming out to the show.
Awesome. Thanks for having me, Bill.
Again, for the audience, this is about the film Higher Love. Be sure to check it out. And if you're on streaming services, you'll see a link in the description. As always, deuces.
This has been The Way Podcast. If you want to know more about The Way Podcast, go to podcasttheway.com.